You want Black Friday prices without the Black Friday crowds. Lowe's gets it. We checked the calendar, and Christmas is coming early. $99 is all you need to grab your favorite select 7-foot pre-lit artificial Christmas tree for the holiday season. And don't sweat what gifts to get Dad, because we've got up to 40% off select tools and accessories. That's how Lowe's celebrates Black Friday early. Selection varies by location while supplies last.
This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
Well, if you watched Dateline on Friday, you found out more about the Adelsons that maybe you knew, maybe you didn't know, but it didn't necessarily paint them in the brightest of lights. We're going to talk about what was revealed, what came out in that program, and what may be still to come in the case of Donna Adelson or Wendy or Harvey. Of course, here we got Todd Michaels, Stacey Cole. You guys all watched it. I'm just going to ask, you know, right off the bat, Stacey, when you watched it, I know you were carving a pumpkin the other day. You sent me a picture while you were doing it. It was a lovely Donna that you carved into the side of the pumpkin. I thought that turned out really good.
It was really good. It was.
Yeah. You got the hair really well. I was really impressed with it. Wouldn't that be great to carve pumpkins like do all the Adelsons?
Oh my gosh, yes. Yeah.
There's still a few days. There's time. There's time.
There is time.
What was your reaction to the episode? Because it focused mainly on the Markells, and we're going to get into all of that here in just a moment.
I appreciated hearing that side. I mentioned to you guys before we went live here today that I really had forgotten some pieces of this case. It's been lingering for so long. So I think it was a really nice way to do a synopsis. And one of the things that I really forgot about was the stupidity of Donna Adelson and her inability to use technology. Mm-hmm. And what I'm referencing is when she kind of didn't hang up the phone and yes. was sitting there talking smack, and they're recording it when she was talking on a prison line, basically, to Charlie, right? Mm-hmm. I mean,
well, that was recorded, and yeah, you're right. There's two parts where she really reveals a lot of shit. There's the I didn't hang up the phone part, and then there's parts where she didn't realize. I mean, she should have. I don't know, but
it was recorded.
Yes.
And she was just like, whatever, you know. But to me, it's just, I'm going to offend some people here, but it's a boomer problem. It really is a boomer issue because it's like, how do you not know this by now? Mm-hmm. How do you not know that these calls are being recorded? You know, every call that you make these days is being recorded for quality assurance. It's being recorded for security purposes. Whatever, you're dealing with somebody in a prison. So there was a lot revealed that I had forgotten about. So it was a nice little refresher course for me.
I don't know that it, I mean, I agree. I mean, the technology thing is going to be an age problem no matter what. But when it comes to someone like that, I don't know that age is necessarily a thing. Because I think if you're a narcissist and you just have that motor that is always going to be telling you, I need to justify this, I need to control the narrative, you can be 25 or you can be whatever she is, what, 70 something?
Yeah.
And I think you're still going to have that same motor, that one that's going to override all, you know, all sensibility, all common sense of just take a breath. Don't say this out loud. This could get really bad really quick. I mean, it's like when you're a little kid and you're just like, I got to say this. Like, you need to scratch that itch.
Yeah.
And with maturity and, you know, just mentally being older and understanding how things work and taking a breath and taking a beat and how just immediate reaction doesn't usually solve problems very well, especially on things like this. If that's there and you've never learned to have patience with it, you're going to do that no matter what.
I agree.
And I feel like it's just one of those things where the certain things are said to her, certain situations come to her, that itch is there. And no matter if there's 20 cameras pointing at her, she's still going to feel I got to scratch that itch no matter what. I'm going to do it. And that self-satisfaction, that self-gratification, whatever it is, that's going to outweigh anything no matter what. It's almost, I don't know, I would almost say in some ways uncontrollable, I would think, in some of these people, where it's not necessarily a conscious decision that she's
so impulsive. I was going to say, I bet they don't even know.
Yeah, I just, and then somehow her mind is telling her that, you know, well, this is going to be better no matter what, because it's worked out so many times for her in the past. Because there's a thousand little cuts that she was able to endure and slice onto all of her victims throughout life, and everything worked fine. So when it came to this big one, well, you've done this all these other times to all these other people, Donna, what's this other? This is going to be fine. It's not going to be a big deal. Yeah. I think that that's how her brain works. But I agree, it is a boomer problem. But I think that's just simply because of the technology. You know, I mean, do you feel it? I feel it today with some of the technology that's out there. I mean, I try to be as versed in it as I can be, and I'm still feeling like I'm always behind. I can't imagine, you know, I can't imagine how they feel right now on some of the stuff that's out there. I mean, we're talking, you know, before AI, when a lot of this stuff was going on, being behind now, it's just, you know, it's another galaxy, it feels.
I feel like every... I'm Gen X, so I feel like I need a Gen Z to kind of, or a millennial, to come and hold my hand and show me, like, hey, let's meet on Sundays at 3 o'clock and you show me the new shit from the week before.
Yeah.
You know, can we just do like a half hour little class? Like, tell me what, was it 6-7?
I don't even know what that means. I don't think, does anyone know it? I don't think there is a meaning to it.
I don't know that they know what it means.
I tried to ask my daughter about it. She's like, I don't think there is a meaning. I think people are just saying it and doing it. I'm like, well, why? Oh, they just are.
Well, and by the way, Daphne in our chat pretty much just called me an idiot. I'm not saying that all boomers are like that. I know a lot of great boomers. I'm not an idiot here, but I know a lot of boomers that really struggle with technology and just get themselves into trouble.
Statistically, you're going to have a higher amount that are. I mean, it's just, yeah, you're going to be less versed in it statistically. Not everybody.
No, not everybody. And there are some that are absolutely beautifully versed in it. But what happens is our world is moving in this technological vacuum. And if you're not keeping up, you are going to fall behind and get into trouble. Oh, I'm sorry, Daphne. She just said Donna was the idiot, not me. I'm sorry, kiddo. Well, that's okay. See, again, technology. You're reading into it incorrectly. But if you are getting behind in technology, look at everything that we do that is on your phone. If you still have, if you have a jitterbug phone, like a lot of us got for our grandparents, you can't do a lot of things. There are some places you can't go.
Are those still around?
If you go to a sporting event, they don't take cash anymore.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
You know, well,
my mom still uses her checkbook. I just feel this is more secure. I'm like, you're literally giving your account number to anyone who wants it, and they're putting it in a drawer.
And a signature on that thing and all that kind of stuff.
And a signature. Like, you are giving everything away.
The one thing I have to say, and I'm not going to disagree with you, Stacey, but Donna did try to use a phone call that was recorded a little bit after that big debacle, where she did try to get her narrative out there. I don't know what they're talking about. So I don't know that it's necessarily like a boomer thing, because when she wants to use technology for her benefit, she certainly seemed to know how to do that.
That's a really good point.
It was good for me to see this, because I had not seen the actual bump video before. So, and Stacey, you and I were talking about this before we went on, about how she actually handled that quite well. She didn't come across in the actual video where she was nervous or, oh my God, she was like, I don't know what you're talking about. Like, that part of it, she actually did pretty well. But then she turned around and called Charlie right away and said, I think there's a problem for both of us, kind of thing, which right then and there put the nails in her coffin.
Yeah.
It was also good to see her. Before she went into prison, to see what kind of look she had and all that kind of stuff.
She was trying to look like Wendy.
Yes, absolutely, like Wendy's sister. But then the complaints about how she had gained weight in prison because the food is so bad and all that kind of stuff. It's like, get out of here with that crap.
Yeah, then don't commit a crime. Then
no
you don't
kidding,
have to worry
right?
about prison food.
Exactly.
That's two thoughts.
Yes.
That's the problem.
Yeah. But the fact that she was complaining about the food in prison is like, it's prison. Even Georgia Kaplman's like, this is prison. It's not supposed to be like Club Med, you know?
Yeah, exactly. It's not a country club.
Right.
That I think, and we were talking about this the other day, at the end of the year here, we're going to put together kind of our greatest hits or our favorite moments of the year. And that, to me, watching that video, because there's a court hearing of Donna Adelson, a fairly inconsequential court hearing about her complaints of what jail is like. This is prior to her trial.
Yeah.
But it's funny to watch. And we'll go back and watch it again, because it's her complaining about everything on the stand to the judge for like 30 minutes.
Yes.
And it's just watching this narcissistic boomer flail and thinking that what she says should be taken into some sort of consideration, has some sort of relevance because of who she is or her age, or like just zero clue that you're not going to get special treatment here because of who you are. And she really genuinely, I think, believes that those were the mechanisms to find relief. And she's utterly shocked when they're not. Yeah. And there's a lot of things she does out loud that are pure theater, because she knows she's trying to manipulate. But when she really thinks that she's going to be, when she's pushed into that corner, that's where you have the collapse. That's where you have these hilarious moments of putting the narcissist in the cage, because they don't know what to do, because they can't do anything. And again, I mean, I've done the video and I'm like, why do we find her so fascinating? Why do we find it so satisfying to watch the narcissist in the cage? Again, it's because so many people know somebody like this, and not necessarily they've gone to this length, but have suffered through their bullshit throughout life. And it's just like, he finally, this represents all of that. It's interesting. I feel like that other doc that we're going to talk about later in this week, the one, The Perfect Neighbor on Netflix, that's another Donna Adelson right there. That woman, the perfect neighbor lady, just completely caught up in themselves, utterly clueless as to anybody else's emotions, feelings, well-being, not remotely even thinking that, gee, you know, there's all these kids out here, they're playing football in the streets, they're running around, they do have parental figures that are nearby watching, making sure that they're okay. You dumb bitch. Like, they'd be out there committing crimes, they could be doing horrible things. They are kids being kids in a rare neighborhood where they feel safe and the parents feel safe enough for them to be out there. But because it disturbs you and your little peace, you want to tear it all down. Never mind, there's all these other people out here that are benefiting, children included. But if it bothers you, then, well, that's all that really matters.
Yeah.
In that court hearing, the other thing that I thought was really cool, you know, they were trying to get her like bond or bail or something like that, so she didn't have to stay in prison. And I thought Georgia did a nice job of saying, well, listen, she's a flight risk. She tried to go off to Vietnam or whatever. But then Donna's also telling the story about how somebody apparently, came up behind her and grabbed her arm and put it behind her back. And she said, you keep it up and you'll lose your pretty white teeth. And I'm looking at Donna's mouth going, okay, first of all, they're not white. Second of all, they're not pretty. And she was a dentist's wife.
So I got surprised by that.
I got a little petty at that point watching Dateline.
I mean, what does that say to? I mean, that's just a fascinating thing. I mean, she's married to a cosmetic dentist. Her son is a cosmetic dentist. These are the folks who can elevate your dental game beyond just cleanings and cavities. Like, they can give you the perfect smile, and you're not doing it.
You're not
taking advantage of that. Like, you think yours is already good enough. And so I don't know. Maybe that's it. I don't know. I mean, it's a weird conundrum there. on that, like, why would you not take advantage of this? You know, if especially when image is so important, but if you're so you already think your image is, you know, the fucking cat's meow. Yeah, then why would you change it? Because you're already there. I don't think I've ever used the cat's meow in a sentence.
Well, let's give you one of these. There you go. Yes. The password is. Yeah,
there we go. There was a letter that was shown on screen. I want to talk about this for a second, then we'll go to the letter. The other moment in that thing for me, and I love how Dateline, I mean, it's a lot of rehashed material, but the order in which it's placed, sometimes the producers do a very good job of putting things into perspective and making you see things in ways that, oh, I knew this, but when presented this way, this does make a little more sense. And the moment for me that really, really got me was the Charlie call, was after the bump, where was the whole, well, what is this about? Are you getting sued? Well, who is this about? Well, it could be about you and me. And she somehow thinks whispering on the phone is going to make it like
that
less.
Changes it, doesn't it?
It's changed. Exactly. It's very infantile in her way of thinking. But that right there was, you wouldn't say that if it wasn't about the two of you. And it's like, well, there we go. Like, if there's ever any doubt, because any all these cases, and I'm someone who always, I second guess myself on everything. So I'm always second guessing, like, my thoughts on a case, because I want to, not that I want to be right, but I want to make sure that I'm seeing it clearly and accurately. And whatever clear and accurate is where I want to be. So if I'm clouded by something, I want to understand that. I'm willing to change my opinion, but I need to hear that. And those little pieces like that are what make me go, yeah, okay, well, yeah.
Yep. And then right after that, too, you know, they showed a clip of Georgia talking with the jury, basically saying, you heard that. Like, this is damning evidence, basically, is what she said. So you're right. Yeah. The way they kind of piece that stuff together, you're like, oh, God. I mean, I knew that. I knew she said those things, but God, that makes so much sense.
Exactly. When the ingredients are the right amount in the dish, it makes it right. When it's messed up, it's hard to tell it sometimes.
Exactly.
I got a letter here. This is this was obtained by Dateline, and we're going to read it. I have the full transcript of the letter. There was a little snippet of it that was read on Dateline. This is the full thing. And this was a letter written in 2024 to Harvey from Donna. And it's about her grandkids and them going to school for the first time. And a couple of things I want you to think about when we read this and you listen to it. Is she writing it to Harvey? Is she truly writing this to Harvey as if he didn't know these things? No. Is this her just verbally throwing up, you know, into a letter of here's all my emotions? Or was this intended for someone else to read to as a piece of theater?
That's where my head went. This is all performance. This is performative. Mm-hmm. This is her making her statement in the only way that she can at this point.
And maybe somebody inside the courtroom or whoever the investigators are will see this and realize what it's doing to her. Again, when she wants to, she can use various forms of technology to try and play the game.
Yeah.
Yep.
So this is it. It starts out with a title. It doesn't start like, Harvey, my love, you wonderful dentite of the world. first day of school, ... This will be the first time I don't get to see the boys and take pictures on their first day of school. Never mind, Dad's dead. And grandparents aren't, you're not allowing them to see their grandchildren whose son you just offed. It breaks my heart that I can't see them or even pictures of them on this special day. Please tell them that I'll be thinking about them and wishing them both a good start to their school year. They had a fun summer with activities, camp, and friends, and now it's time to get to work. Please tell them, if I get a fair trial,
I'll get out of jail and come to see them in Austin. If not, I want them to do the best they can because that will make me happy.
Because I'm sure they're just like, what can we do to make Donna happy?
Yeah, how can we help her?
How telling is that, though, that the first thing she's saying is, it'll make me happy.
It'll make me happy. Because this is, because she thinks everyone's there to serve her.
Yes.
That there's no, like, the world is simply Donna's oyster to conquer, and everyone else works for her.
Yep. Yep.
I, you know, when you guys were kids, did you ever like, I mean, I remember like, you know, you're trying to figure out the world and you're running things through your mind. You're like, I'm like, what if I am the only one? Like, what if all this is just like, you know, just you yes. run weird thoughts through your head.
Sure.
And then you go, well, that's fucking insane. Like, of course it's not. There's other people here. They have feelings. And like, I think some people lock into that thought and go, well, that's how this works. And then that's modality for the rest of their lives.
I think mm-hmm. you're right. I think you're right.
If this state convicts me like they did to their uncle.
Their uncle. Like,
wait,
wouldn't you say my son?
Yeah.
Right, right.
For a crime had no pardon. I want them to remember all the fun things we did together. I do not want them to visit me in prison. I just want them to remember the good times. If I don't get out, then hopefully I die soon so that no one remembers me in prison garb behind bars.
Donna, that's the only way people are going to remember you, actually. That's the only legacy you have.
Can I just say something here? I guess you could call my dad a histrionic person. Mm-hmm. My mom and dad had a very contentious custody battle. We were in mm-hmm. court all the time. I actually had to get up on the stand and testify against my dad that he was a horrible parent so that mm-hmm. I didn't have to go spend summers with him. Long sordid story. But
yeah.
he would call up on a Sunday after, was it before five? I think it was before five. This is a long time ago. Long distance became more expensive after a certain time frame when people had landlines. Because, yes, yeah. I'm a little older. And he would say, oh, I'm not feeling well. I've been having chest pains. I may die. And it was just this horrible guilt trip of I'm going to die soon. And finally, one time I said, well, you didn't die last week, so I think your odds are pretty good for this week.
Yeah.
I mean, knock it off. We're all going to die.
It's what they do.
Exactly.
It is what they fucking do.
Yes.
And it's like it's a scripted play. When this doesn't work, when that doesn't work, when all yep. the levers that they used to pull that were able to manipulate people, simply the slot machine's not plugged in anymore and it's not going, what do? You're ill.
Yes.
You're sick. And they all fucking do it.
When my dad finally died, Tony,
yeah.
when my brother called and said that my dad had died, I said, are you sure?
Yeah.
Because the guy had been dying my entire fucking life.
Exactly. Exactly. I've seen it. I've seen it in my own personal life. I'll share a little fun stuff here. So the narcissist in your life, mm-hmm. the narcissist that was in my life for many years, narcissist borderline, all that. Two fake cancer scares.
Oh yeah. We had one of those. Yep. Mm-hmm.
And then also tell the children that too.
Oh my.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, well, think of what it does to a kid.
Holy
to
shit.
To have them traumatized that their parent's going to die.
Yeah. And then you wonder why your child wants.
You do that to a kid.
No. And then you wonder why no child wants anything to do with you. It's right. like, well, you already traumatized one this way. And then you add this in of like yep. when all the levers weren't working, it was I'm dying of cancer.
Yeah. Yeah.
And oh, my God. And as a healthy person.
Yeah.
When you hear that from someone, you have empathy.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
And that's
you're
what
you're supposed to.
That's what they're betting on, you know, and eventually, yep. I mean, it's like the boy who cried wolf, but like in a real, real visceral, sick level. And you go, I can't believe someone would do this.
Right.
And And I don't know sometimes if they actually believe the shit they're saying. Maybe they do. But sometimes it's just when all else fails, I'm going to be deathly ill. And you can see it when folks like this begin to collapse.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm not going to say any names. I'm not going to say there's one I'm watching in real time. I think some of us are watching in real time narcissistically collapse right now. I can guarantee illness will be next. I can fucking
always
guarantee it.
Always.
I can guarantee there's going to be a feigning of an illness soon.
Do you want to do a bet right here on the podcast? Because we can all throw up some money to see what happens here. I've got $5 in my wallet. What about you, Stacey?
I think I've got a $2 bill hanging around somewhere that I've been saving for years.
I mean, I'll take the two out of that.
Are we going to put a timeline on the date that the illness appears?
I think it's going to be before the end of the year.
I do too. It's going to be at an inopportune time for everyone else. It will probably be a holiday.
I was just going to say
Thanksgiving or Christmas, because they also do that. Narcissists will pick the holiday or whatever moment is important to someone else.
Yep.
So it will either be on a holiday or someone's birthday or some momentous occasion in their life, some sort of achievement that's going on. That's when it's already in queue. You know, in the back of their mind, they're like, it's cocked, it's ready to go. And there will be a feigned illness in that scenario. But there is in everybody's scenario when these sort of things happen. Again, I'm not going to say more about that as far as who, but I think a lot of us know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, we do.
Stacey's in for $2 at Christmas. I got that written
Christmas.
Down.
Christmas?
Christmas Eve.
I'm going to go.
I don't know that it's going to, I think it's going to be desperate and it's going to be needed sooner, seeing that, because the implosion we're watching is insane. I'm going to go Thanksgiving.
Okay.
And I think the feigned illness.
Okay. I'm going to go with Festivus. Festivus for mine, for my
friends. Festivus, by the way.
Technically what? There's a date for it.
Yeah, let me look that up. Because I do celebrate it every year. I didn't, when I moved out of my house, I didn't bring my Festivus pole, but I had a pole out in the garage. Like that kind of pole.
Yeah,
not
whatever.
That kind of pole.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. She's spinning around.
What's
the
this?
Pole.
It's a Festivus pole. Bullshit. Nobody attaches a Festivus pole to the ceiling.
Why is
it wasn't
like
attached.
Strobe
it was
lights?
Just a pole on a stand.
Why is there baby oil all over it?
That would be hard. You've got to slide down the pole then.
Stop.
That would be, But I'm going to go Thanksgiving. I'm going to go Thanksgiving on that one. That's my guess. I don't know.
Right, we'll Festivus 2025 is December 23rd. It's a Tuesday.
Okay.
Yeah.
So on that, we're live that week? Are we not live that week? I don't think so.
On what?
The 23rd
Christmas?
Of December.
No, I think we're going
to
be not.
Right, so we'll have to do our Festivus celebration early where we do the airing of the grievances.
That'll be fun.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think there'll be definitely a serious feigned illness, and no one will know the difference because you can't like go get medical records and be like, hey, this is what's happening. And so it's going to either you're going to be on board with it or you're not. And I don't know what I'm watching there. There's a lot of people jumping ship. So yeah, that'll happen. And Donna, we're going to see Donna. We're going to see Donna feign some illness here too.
Yeah.
So it's just part of, it's like they, when I started learning about borderlines, narcissists, history, all that shit, the dark triad of insane.
Yeah.
It's like the joke is they all went to the same convention because they all like go off the same fucking playbook and they all think they're so unique in it. And they all think nobody's going to see this. Nobody's going to like see through my bullshit. If I say it aloud, people are going to be like, well, that's true.
Yep. they all have the same swag bag.
And the thing is a lot of people do. And that's the scary part of it. But Donna, I'm sure, is going to go, you know, that'll be on her thing as well. Let's continue with the letter here. It says, that's not what I want, of her being behind bars. Doesn't want the kids to remember her that way. Please remember this. I'm holding on the best I can. Every day is a challenge. I believe that I should come home, but I'm realistic too. We all saw the 2-hour deliberation and the decision to put my son behind bars for life. This is still Tallahassee,
Kappelman is still the hometown Southern sweetheart prosecutor who's gotten convictions on everyone in this case. She just wants another notch in her belt. She doesn't care about the truth. This is vigilante justice. Just building and telling herself, like, thank you for letting Harvey know this, I guess. And these jurors have to go back to their friends, neighbors, and coworkers and explain why they wouldn't convict another Adelson. It's easier to just convict and be done. Thank you for being strong and hanging in there with me. I love you more than you can imagine. Thank you for being you. I love you so much. Donna Sue.
That was the part right there that made me want to puke.
Yeah.
Donna Sue. Ugh. Oh. I think when I do my Donna accent, I usually always put a little English accent in it, too. So it's always, oh, yes. Poor me.
You got to have the vibrato.
Queen? Yeah. No.
There's a lot of that going on.
I love you so much, Harvey. You stand by. It's kind of like Katharine Hepburn. But
I was going to say, you do a really good one, too.
It is. It really is. The Markells, and I'll read their statement because they put it out, and I think we did read this the other day, but for context, this is what the Markells have said about the whole situation. During sentencing, our family listened in disbelief to the disrespectful and delusional statements made by both Donna and Harvey Adelson before Donna's sentencing for first-degree murder and other convictions of our son and brother, Dan Markell. Contrary to Donna's claim, she never mourned the loss of Danny's life, nor did she ever express concern for his sons losing their father. Yep. Testimony at her trial showed her callous indifference to his murder, including written evidence that she dismissed the very idea that the boy could be sad or miss their dad. It is deeply unfortunate that Harvey used this time before the court to challenge our family's account of our relationship with Ben and Lincoln. We will set the record straight as we have in court and elsewhere. Our family was cut off from contact with the boys for 6 full years from the moment authorities implicated Adelson family members in Danny's murder until 1 hour after the Florida legislature passed the Markell Act. Since then, our interactions have been limited, mainly through Wendy's supervised Zoom calls and short visits. Wendy refuses to share their address, and gifts that we send must be mailed to her lawyer's office. We were uninvited to Benjamin's bar mitzvah following Charlie's arrest, and were never invited to Lincoln's. We grieve the years lost and the years ahead without independent and direct contact with them. Beyond her crimes, Donna scorned Danny, drove deliberate wedges between him and Wendy, and disparaged him to his own sons. Her display of emotion before the court was not remorse for Danny's death, but sorrow for consequences she now faces for causing it. We thank the court, prosecutors, jurors, and law enforcement for their steadfast commitment to bringing justice to Donna Adelson for her role in this terrible crime. That's the letter. And there was something that Dan's father said on Dateline on Friday, and I'm just going to read it. It was at the very end of the episode. He said, you know, wouldn't it be, he said this to Wendy, wouldn't it be nice if we could arrange for the boys, you included, to let them see where their father grew up,
let them see
where he's buried? She said that will never happen.
That broke my heart.
Yeah.
And I'm somebody who, you know, I watch the world news at 5:30 or whatever. And the last story is always one of those that are supposed to like grab you by the heartstrings. Mm-hmm. And I always weep at those. So I'm a little wuss when it comes to that stuff. But when Mr. Markell said that, I just couldn't believe it. You could hear the pain in his voice.
Yeah. We want to be part of their life. We want them to see how much love we have for them. That's how that ended. And yeah, I mean, Jesus Christ. I mean, God damn. And it may not, you know, God knows what these kids think of their grandparents after what the Adelsons have fed them over the years. I mean, it's probably not as easy as flipping a switch. They're in their mid-teens. If they have their mindset made of who they are, and as everyone is at one point in time, young and dumb. They are products of what they've been brought up around. And unfortunately, it's been mainly the Adelsons. So it's probably going to take several years for them to, if they ever do, break out of that shell and see the world around them for what it is. The sad part is, by the time they get there, their grandparents may not be around anymore.
Well, and here's the sad and yet beautiful part about this is once they become independent and they can make their own decisions, I would put money on the fact that they are probably going to reach out to those grandparents and say, I'm sorry that we missed out on so much with you. Let's make up for lost time. Once Maybe. They don't have somebody pulling the puppet strings.
I'm hoping that's the case. The thing is, mm-hmm. is that will happen much quicker if Donna is actually taken into the courtroom herself. And a lot of people are asking in our chat, do we think that's going to happen?
Yes.
I don't know.
I mean, Wendy is going to continue. Like people like this don't change. And this is all complete conjecture. Wendy's obviously never been charged with anything. She maintains her innocence. But just generally speaking here, my experience, I think from anyone's experience, narcissists don't change. And no, if this don't. Is your modality, this is how you operate, and you're literally telling, you know, the grandparents that will never happen. And she could even like give a little bullshit, like, well, maybe someday, maybe this summer or something. It's like, that will never happen. Wow. That's a really cold, calculated, like, Isn't you're it? Just flat out saying it. Okay. That's never going to change. She's going to, in my opinion, I'm going to guess this is going to be her modality until the day she dies too, which will probably be a very long time from now. And these kids, this is the only family they know. This is the only family they have. And that's why these cycles are able to go on for as long as they do, because people don't want to be uncomfortable. Right. They're not going to break out of the cycle if everything in the cycle over here is home. No matter how fucked up that home is. Some do break away, but they're typically looked at as the odd duck. Mm-hmm. It's not like the majority move away and there's the one that sticks around. It's usually one that breaks and then everybody else stays and continues to feed the demon. And so who knows? I mean, I really hope that they do at some point, have that reckoning. You know, we on this show, when we've had like Siobhan and stuff on, there's been many times where we've gotten done talking about, you know, their lives, you know, from, you know, the 1,000-foot perspective of not living them. And, you know, if you could say something to those kids the day that they're someday scrolling and looking for their history, what would you say to them? You know, because I think they're going to find they will be able to find perspective on their lives through outside sources in ways no one else has in the past. Mm-hmm. So I think that is going to be helpful to them in ways that, you know, other people may not have had. So I don't know. We'll see. We'll see if that is something that helps.
I'll just say this. I'm ready for Wendy in court. I think that it'll be good watching. I think that I'd love to see Georgia go after it and see what happens. And see if there's a jury that makes a decision in 3 hours, like her brother and her mama. So,
yeah, it'll be fascinating. They are victims of circumstance right now. And hopefully the future is brighter them. Hopefully their uncle maybe can step in and give him a little reality check. Cause I doubt it's going to be coming from Wendy, in my opinion, but it's a messed up story, all around. But that's the latest, on the Adelsons. Speaking of crazy, Lori Vallow Daybell was in court just the other week. She had a new hearing, and just like Brian Koberger, just in that a different sort of chaotic, dark triad of narcissistic thinking, she too doesn't like the idea of paying back restitution. Doesn't think she should have to do it. Why? Well, if other people have done it. And it all goes back to GoFundMe. Well, GoFundMe's paying this to people. Why should I have to? Because you're the one that was convicted of the crime. Isn't it fascinating that some people will take that GoFundMe somebody else is already providing that for them, so that should be good enough for me.
Yeah. You know, you did the crime. You should pay.
Yes. I mean, where in history has this ever been like this, where it's like, well, someone else is going to make you whole, so why should I have to? I mean, if you get a civil judgment against you, there's no like, well, you already got whole from your GoFundMe, so I don't have, I'm off the hook for that now.
Right.
And somehow think that arguing that aloud, speaking that into the atmosphere, into the world, is somehow going to make it happen. Yeah. But that's the magical narcissistic thinking that these people have. Let's watch some of this. It's a short piece of the hearing of Lori Vallow Daybell. And then after that, we're going to watch a little bit of Chad telling ghost stories.
And CR 2022-001-242, State of Arizona versus Lori Daybell. Is Ms. Daybell on? Is that the Joab Fedorf?
It's talking about the...
Mr. Lund, could I have you turn your camera off just to not be a distraction?
Oh. Here we go. Lori has shown up on the camera.
All right, I called the case. Let's have a state announce.
Trina K on behalf of the state.
And defendant?
Lori Daybell for the defense.
All right, I can hear everyone fine. This is the time set for restitution hearing. Have there been any agreements?
Your Honor, I am not sure. I was going to check with Ms. Daybell if she would stipulate to anything. I do have one correction in the documents. On bait stamp 101133, what we've learned is that the gas receipts that were provided are not all of the gas receipts, and so that's why we had done the mileage, but we forgot to remove the gas receipts themselves. So we should actually remove $348.98, which would make the total restitution request $8,600.54.
Okay, I'll ask the defendant, are you stipulating to any restitution?
Your Honor, on Wednesday night, I did receive those Bates numbers that were supposed to be given to me from my advisory council. They mailed them to me. I just got them. I was able to review those. Those ended at Bates number 101161. And yesterday, I was informed by my advisory council that the state sent over one more document on Tuesday by email to my advisory council. And I have not seen that document. It's Bates number 101162. It is my understanding, since I talked to my advisory council yesterday, that that document... is a document... They kind of explained it, what it was to me. And so my understanding is, and although I'm aware that counseling, thank you. Although I'm aware that counseling costs can be included in restitution, this document turned over by the state is an Excel spreadsheet totaling $3,147 in counseling. There are no invoices from doctors or insurance companies to my knowledge. So the document in and of itself seems to be insufficient. I haven't actually seen it. However, based on how my trials were conducted, since experience tells me that regardless of what I say or what anybody else says, you're going to order it, I am willing to stipulate today. It is my understanding that I have already been ordered by this court to pay over $534,000 in fees, in fines, surcharges, and court fees. So you can add Ms. Woodcock's total of $12,096.97 of restitution to my tab.
And Your Honor, okay, with that correction, it would actually be $11,747.99.
Hold on, $11,747.99. All right, Ms. Daybell, you're stipulating to pay restitution to Kay Woodcock in the amount of $11,747.99. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Any drugs, alcohol, or medication in the last 24 hours that would affect your ability to make this decision?
Have I been on any drugs, Your Honor? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
No, I'm asking, have you had any drugs, alcohol, or medication that would affect your ability to understand or make this decision today?
Is Your Honor aware that I am in prison? I have no access to any of those things. So, no, the answer is no, I have not.
Well, then you're missing out, Lori.
Has anyone promised you anything in exchange for your agreement to pay this restitution?
No.
Has anyone forced you, threatened you, or coerced you to get you to agree to pay this restitution?
Only my trials, Your Honor, coerced me.
Oh, God.
All right. The court finds that your agreement is knowingly, intelligently, voluntarily made. It's ordered that you pay $11,747.99 in restitution to Kay Woodcock. The restitution would take priority over any other fines and fees that have been imposed. And it's ordered that that restitution be paid out at the maximum rate allowable out of any prison account. Ms. Kay, do you anticipate any other restitution requests?
Your Honor, we are still awaiting restitution requests from Brandon Boudreau. I know that he's been busy with work and he hasn't got all of those documents together. When I get those, I will submit them to advisory counsel and to Ms. Daybell's investigator, who seems to be able to get that to her much easier. And just for the record, Ms. Woodcock is still ongoing counseling, so there could be subsequent requests.
Well, the court retains jurisdiction over the matter of restitution for the period that the defendant is serving a sentence. So I'm not setting any further hearings at this time. We'll wait and see if any requests for hearing come in. All right. Thank you. We'll be at recess.
Thank you.
And Lori just sits there blissfully unaware, shaking her head.
How rude. I mean, I'm sorry, but like you're in front of a judge. You've been, you know, sentenced and all this kind of stuff. Don't you have some?
No.
Because the rules don't apply to her.
No, she has no respect for this system whatsoever.
No, because the system doesn't go along with what she... I mean, this is just, you know, this is... The collapse has happened and we're in crazy land is basically where I think Lori Vallow lives. It's beyond collapse anymore. It's just...
You realize I'm in prison, correct?
No shit, Sherlock.
Entertaining.
I don't know. If I were the judge, I wouldn't put up with that. I'd be like... I don't know. Do something else.
I think
he's
used to it now, Todd. I think he just goes, I got to ask the questions. I got to check the box saying I asked her this.
I was really hoping that during the trial they would have used the shock belt. Because she had one on. They literally had her hooked up to one where if she was going to get nuts, they could press the button.
I wish like they had,
But they did not. Because she kept it kind of controlled, and I think she's a train wreck, so people just kind of want to watch it anyhow and go, oh my God, this is not good. The way restitution works in every state is a little bit different here, but in Idaho, 20% of whatever you make, and like, well, you're in prison, how do you make money? You can make money in prison. Mm-hmm. Like if you have a duty, a job, you can make like $25 a month cleaning the kitchen, whatever it may be. It's like chores basically. And you get severely underpaid, just like your parents severely would underpay allowances. And then 20% of that then goes into restitution. It also can happen if someone puts money into your account. So if there's an outside source, if somebody gives Lori $100, $20 of that is going to go back to restitution. And then it gets divided out to all the places that restitution is supposed to be paid. So I know some people are wondering, how do they get money? That's how. That's why it's so important. In Idaho, there are also no Son of Sam laws. The Son of Sam law is the law that basically was in place for the Son of Sam murders, where you can't profit off of your crimes. You can't write a book and make $1 million. Some states have these. Some do not. Idaho does not. Meaning, in another case where we have the same sort of thing going on, Koberger arguing that the GoFundMe should just completely suffice the victims, is if Koberger were to get that money, that then he should not have to pay anything back. So if Koberger can write a book, Koberger can make money off of his crimes.
Dang it.
Yeah. That is there because there are no laws in that state that prohibit that from happening. I don't know if you got one in place now, if that would prevent it because the law would go in place after the conviction. I don't know the answer to it. It's probably somewhat of a legal gray area, but that's why these things do matter. Because of that. Now, you know, what's Koberger going to do with, you know, whatever he makes in commissary? It's a lot of Cheetos.
Right.
But only 20% goes back to pay that restitution. But that's why these things matter. They seem silly, but when that's all you have left, that's like the last little thing you can control, you know, they're going to fight for it. They're going to fight for whatever bit of control they still have. So there's Lori. Really-
Yeah, I kind of forgot how much I missed her. Is that just
don't we all?
Wrong? Yeah,
don't we all miss Lori? I was so happy when it was done. But every once in a while, I don't mind a little visit to see what's going on in the land of crazy. Speaking of the land of crazy,
yay! Do we have time?
Her hubby, yeah. Let's. It's a long piece, and he goes into. When he gets to musical taste, he basically goes on about Christian rock, and I don't really care about that. Let's listen to this. Let's listen to Chad Daybell's. We're going to go to letter number 7. And remember Chad letters from chad.com? They were supposed to be releasing like two a week.
Yes.
Like months ago. We've only have 7 so far after several months. I think they may have kind of gotten the hint. Maybe his kids have gotten the hint who are posting these that this has turned into just pure comedy gold and not actually Chad getting to tell his story.
Right.
I'm happy to be part of destroying that. So hi, Chad's kids. If you have any clue in the world, go do something else. Don't waste your time on your shitty father.
No, we want to keep seeing these, Tony. Come on.
Well, it's, you know, someone finding, you know, a path in life that doesn't involve insanity or us getting the letters. I'm gonna go on the humane route and go do something else. Please get away as far as you can from these mad, crazy people that unfortunately you were born into. Just look at him as a sperm donor and not a good one.
He's gross.
I mean, sick. It's true. That's all
had
he
to go
is.
There.
That's how you're going to have to look at your dad because he's a piece of shit. So this is letter number 7. And with it, this is fun because it's Halloween week. So it times out quite well.
Yes.
Chad is telling ghost stories. And I put together some lovely graphics with this if you're watching us on YouTube. If not, Hidden Killers with Tony Brewski. We're going to get to hear some ghost stories from Chad Daybell. Let's listen.
When I was Springville's cemetery sexton, most days were calm. But there were times when things got a little spooky. The most tangible ghostly experience I had happened after we buried a man named Eddie, who had been known in town as a petty thief. His burial spot wasn't far from my office, and almost immediately after his graveside service, strange incidents started occurring. For example, the morning after Eddie's burial, I arrived at work and noticed the gate to the enclosure where we parked the backhoe and dump truck was swung open. This was unusual because I always made sure the gate was locked as I departed each evening. I possibly left the gate open on accident the first time, but after the same thing happened the next 2 days, I strongly suspected Eddie was still picking locks and causing mischief, despite being dead. When I left for work after the third incident, I tucked a piece of plastic around the lock in a certain way so I could tell if someone touched it. I even drove back to check the lock that night after dark, and it was still fastened securely with the plastic in place. However, when I checked the gate early the next morning, it had been pushed open a few inches. The lock was undone, even though the plastic looked untouched. I wasn't amused by this ghostly prankster. The biggest surprise came moments later when I checked the shed next to my office. The shed had a padlock that required a key I kept on my keychain. But not only was the shed unlocked, but the padlock itself was hooked on a peg above the door. By this point, I wasn't scared. I was irritated. I figured Eddie was nearby, probably pleased I had noticed his handiwork. So I turned around and said, "Hey, Eddie, listen to me.
Hey, Eddie.
I'm impressed with your skills, but you're going to get me in trouble. What if someone sees the open gate and steals the backhoe? I'd get fired." I paused for a few seconds, then added, "Eddie, you don't belong here. There's a better place for you. Look around, go toward the light, and don't come back." He must have listened, because any problems with the locks stopped that very day. The Springville Evergreen Cemetery has a good, positive vibe, but there were a couple of areas where negative feelings were very strong. One section caused me anxiety, although there was no logical reason for it. I sensed I was treading on someone's territory, and they were bothered I was there. I'd never shared these feelings with anyone, though, until our cemetery secretary brought me a burial order. She pointed out the location, then said, "I hate that part of the cemetery. It gives me the creeps." I explained to her that I felt the same way in that area. She grimaced and actually shivered from head to toe. She said, "It feels like someone is playing with my hair when I'm over there." But my most frightening cemetery experience happened in another area. One woman's grave was well known for being supposedly haunted, and I avoided it. But it so happened someone died who would be buried in the plot next to the haunted grave. In order to put the new burial in the right spot, I would have to use one of our metal probing rods to push down through the soil and locate the concrete vault of the haunted grave. I've analyzed what happened in the next few seconds 1,000 times in my mind. But there is no denying that when the probing rod hit the vault, an electrical shock jolted my body. I dropped the rod and shook my arms until they stopped tingling. I wondered if I'd struck an underground power line, but it was impossible. I grabbed the probing rod once again, and this time when I touched the vault, it felt like somebody shoved me viciously in the chest. I took off running as fast as I could. I sensed an angry, demon-like spirit right on my heels, and it chased me all the way to my office. I could feel the demon clawing at me. Every inch of my body was covered in goosebumps, and I was praying out loud the entire way. My office was several hundred yards from the grave, but I covered the distance in record time. I was completely terrified. When I dug the grave with the backhoe the next day, I stayed as far from the haunted vault as I possibly could. I wasn't going to risk the chance of another violent supernatural encounter, and thankfully nothing happened. I later read the autobiography of Heber C. Kimball, a very prominent LDS church leader in the 1800s. He endured a demonic attack while on a church mission in England that reminded me of my own experience. He was struck with great force by some invisible power and fell senseless to the floor. Two other missionaries helped him sit on the bed. Then all three of them could distinctly see evil spirits who gnashed their teeth at them. Heber said, "We saw the devils in legions with their leaders who came within a few feet of us. They came toward us like armies rushing to battle. They appeared to be men of full stature, possessing every form and feature of men in the flesh, who were angry and desperate." He added, "I learned the power of the adversary, his enmity against the servants of God, and got some understanding of the spirit world." Source, Life of Heber C. Kimball by Orson F. Whitney, pages 144 to 145. Thankfully, the positive cemetery experiences outnumbered the negative ones. Most graveside services carried a good feeling, and it was easy to sense that loved ones of the deceased were in attendance. These spirits were eager to welcome their friend or relative back home and to congratulate them on a life well lived. One tender moment for me was at the conclusion of an older woman's graveside service. She and I had been neighbors for several years, and I had sometimes assisted her with yard work and other mundane tasks. As her family members returned to their vehicles, it felt like she came to my side. I could sense how happy she was to graduate and continue on with her eternal journey. A warm sensation filled my heart, and I sensed she was thanking me for the help I had given her over the years. I was filled with an assurance that we'd see each other again in a future day. It was also at the cemetery that I got the message to begin my career as an author. Writing books was another phase of my life. I had seen in the video snippets shown to me during my near-death experience at La Jolla Cove, but I hadn't been given any context of when or how this would happen. I figured it would be later in life, not while I was still in my 20s. A big snowstorm had hit Springville overnight, so I got up early to plow the snow from the cemetery roadways. There was also a funeral coming that day, so I began shoveling a wide path across the lawn to the gravesite. Then from out of nowhere, I heard Grandpa Keith's familiar voice. He simply said, "It's time to write your books." I leaned on the snow shovel and said aloud, "That's great, but I have no idea what to write about." Almost immediately, the entire plot of my first novel filled my mind. I quickly finished shoveling the path to the gravesite, then I took my lunch break and spent a few minutes jotting down a summary of the storyline. I worked on the book each night at home for the next few weeks. When I felt satisfied the book was ready, I submitted the manuscript to Cedar Fort Publishing. I was soon offered a publishing contract. To my surprise, the novel became a regional bestseller, and I ended up publishing my first 12 books with Cedar Fort. I was confident that my books were inspired from a heavenly source, and I knew writing them was helping fulfill my promise to Grandpa Keith, but it always helps when the adversary reinforces that you are on the right track. One night, as I was falling asleep, I heard a rustling noise outside our bedroom window. As I lay there, a dozen voices suddenly shouted in unison, "We hate your books." It was fairly loud, and I looked over at Tammy, but she hadn't awakened. Then they repeated the phrase. I jumped out of bed and looked out the window, but no one was there. The voices were high-pitched and certainly not mortal. I knew I'd been visited by evil spirits. Even though I couldn't see them, I sensed they were milling around my yard, and I could feel their anger at me. The LDS Church teaches that families can pray and dedicate their homes to protect against evil spirits, and we had done that when we moved in. But now I rededicated our home and expanded it to include all of our property. I asked Heavenly Father and His angels to remove these demons and stop them from returning. It was a relief to feel them depart, and we didn't have any more trouble with them after that. Although the encounter was frightening, it actually strengthened me to know the adversary and his demons weren't pleased with the books I was writing. Bookshelf.
A bookshelf.
I was employed as Springville's cemetery sexton for several years before moving into the book publishing world on a full-time basis. As I mentioned in an earlier letter, our book company started off with great success. Then in 2008, the entire publishing industry began feeling the effects of the Great Recession. At our annual booksellers convention, I met with other publishers, and we tried to reassure each other that our companies would survive. After all, during the Great Depression in the 1930s, the citizens had turned to books as their main form of entertainment during hard times. Well, history didn't repeat itself in this age of the internet. We were barely able to keep Spring Creek Books afloat. We did bounce back a few years later, but in the meantime, it was clear I needed to find a different full-time job. In a strange twist of fate, it meant a return for me to the cemetery business.
Right?
Spanish Fork's cemetery sexton was retiring, and I applied and got the job. In some ways, it was surreal, because when you grow up in Springville, your main rival is Spanish Fork. But I felt welcome, and I had great co-workers. I want to share a Spanish Fork ghost story because it was a situation where I didn't see anything, but my two co-workers did. I'll call them Derek and Sam to protect their privacy. The story begins as we were filling a grave in the part of the cemetery where original settlers were buried. As Derek and Sam waited by the grave, I drove the backhoe to our dirt pile a few hundred yards away and returned with a scoop of dirt. As I got closer, I saw Derek and Sam both backing away from the grave. Sam was nervously pointing at something, and then Derek actually hid behind Sam. Something had clearly spooked them. I dumped the load of dirt in the grave, then turned off the backhoe and hopped out. Derek and Sam started shoveling the dirt as if nothing had happened. But then Sam asked me, "Did you see him too?" "What do you mean?" I asked. They looked at each other in surprise. Sam stammered for a moment before walking to a spot about 10 feet from the grave. He said, "There was a boy standing right here. He was watching us. Derek added that the boy was wearing old-style clothes and that he vanished into thin air when I got closer with the backhoe. I asked them if they could see through him, and they both shook their heads. Derek said, I thought he was a real kid at first. He stood there for at least 30 seconds. We discussed that experience many times during the rest of the summer, and we marveled that both Derek and Sam saw the boy. I would always write down memorable cemetery stories such as this one, and I eventually published a nonfiction book titled One Foot in the Grave. The first version was published after I finished working for Springville City. I later updated the book with a new cover and added several of my Spanish Fork experiences. There are numerous funny stories included, along with a good description of what it is like to work in a cemetery. Despite these occasional humorous incidents, I always took my duties as sexton very seriously. I regarded it as a sacred honor to care for the cemetery grounds and to perform burials properly with professionalism. Most importantly, I always made sure the deceased were shown complete dignity and respect. I knew better than anyone that my employees and I were on holy ground with friends and relatives watching us from the other side. I'm grateful for that unique opportunity and for the experiences I had that made me a better person.
There we go. You want to hear more of that? I'll post the full video later today on our YouTube channel.
I'm not sure what's scarier, his stories or his use of the term probing rod several times.
I was trying to not snicker because I'm like, wait a minute, did we just launch into his novel?
Probing rod. Hey, Lori, come here. It's probing rod night. We just had a delicious Stouffer's chicken dinner. Now it's time to use the probing rod together.
Is that what he calls it?
I mean... Look, you're to the kids. He's a sperm donor from his probing rod, and that's your dad.
We just got a message and sexton. Yes, and the term sexton is also interesting hearing him say that.
So there you go. There's some Chad Daybell ghost stories.
I needed that more than you probably even understand, Tony. That was perfect.
Yes, Todd. Thank you, because I have been begging for this for weeks now. And we're sitting on number 7. We've just stopped at number 7, and it just pains my heart.
Chad, we'd like more.
Please?
Chad, if you're listening or if your kids are listening, please write us more.
Give us something.
Let's hear the holidays. I want to hear what the holidays were like for the Daybells. Yeah. I want to hear what happened at Thanksgiving. I want to hear about the turkey loaf. I want to hear about the canned cranberries. I want to hear about how, you know, that one Christmas, that one thing happened that changed you forever. We don't have to talk about it, you know, right now, but we'd love you to write about it and share it with us.
Just
I don't know
give
what that is,
that.
But share it. Share it with us, please. What do you think little Chad Daybell would have asked for Christmas when he was a kid?
A shovel.
Yeah, I could see that. Practical, practical use for a shovel.
The guy, every story he tells seems to come back around to a shovel. And I don't mean to make light.
Yeah.
I understand that there's so much tragedy in this story, but something about that, I just need to go to the other side and find the humor because it's so effing dark. Please, no disrespect, but the guy is just sick.
Well, I think he enjoyed his life as a cemetery sexton. I mean, he talks about it seemingly fondly. And I suppose you could find joy in that. I enjoy cemeteries. I enjoy hanging out of them. If that was my plight in life and that's what was, you know, what presented itself as being the job, I don't know. I should make the best of it.
Jean just mentioned, she said, hopefully he'll get writing. The divine being will give him ideas for letters. I love it. Perfect.
Yes. It's coming to you soon, Chad. Tell us more. Tell us more.
Tell us what's in your heart.
Yeah. So there you go. Chad Daybell, letter number 7. He's leaving us hanging. Holidays are coming up, Chad. Come on. Deliver like Santa Claus. Deliver.
Chadley Claus.
You know you want to. All right. that's going to wrap up our program for today. Let us know your thoughts in the comments section on YouTube. If you're not already there, search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi and you will find us. And press subscribe, whatever podcast platform you are listening to us on, so you don't miss any of our coverage of this and the many cases that we got for you right here. All right. Until next time, for Stacey and Todd, I'm Tony. We will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.